Welcome to Session 4 of Mind in the Cosmos. The title of this session is Language, Energy, and Consciousness. How often have you heard people use phrases such as the energy of consciousness, or psychic vibrations, or even fields of consciousness, and more recently, non-local consciousness? Well, in this session, we're going to look closely at our use of language to see if maybe we're mistaken when we borrow language from physics, which describes the outer cosmos, in our attempts to understand the interior cosmos of the mind or consciousness. So perhaps words such as energy, vibrations, and fields are useful metaphors for talking about consciousness, but do they help us if we apply them literally to describe the structure or functions of the mind or spirit? Is such terminology a kind of physics envy, a hangover or conceptual habit inherited from our Newtonian heritage? What might be more appropriate language for talking about consciousness? That's what we're about to explore. New Age holistic spiritual metaphysicians and materialist reductionists make strange bedfellows. Nevertheless, when it comes to talking about consciousness, both turn to concepts and images derived from physics. Materialists claim that consciousness is ultimately nothing but a form of matter-energy. New Agers often talk of consciousness as spirit in terms of vibrations, waves, fields, and so on, as though it were a form of subtle energy. Well, at least the materialists are consistent, since according to them, everything is physical. It makes sense to talk of consciousness in terms of energy. But the New Agers, it seems, are a little muddled and confused. They want it both ways. On the one hand, they claim that ultimate reality is spirit or consciousness. Yet on the other, they want to describe consciousness in the language of physics, using energy talk. The problem with both materialists and New Agers is that they are trapped in the strange attractor of conceiving the world in terms of spatial kinesthetics, that is, mechanical metaphors. To advance in our understanding of mind and how it relates to matter, I propose that consciousness talk needs to shift from using mechanistic metaphors to meaning metaphors, and from space talk to time talk, derived from our direct experience of consciousness itself. We have a bias in our language. Niels Bohr, one of the founders of quantum physics, said, "We are hanging in language. We are suspended in language in such a way that we cannot say what is up and what is down." The problem, Bohr insisted, was not the quantum wonderland itself, but our language, our ways of thinking and talking about the quantum wonderland. His colleague, Werner Heisenberg, went a step further and proclaimed that events in the quantum wonderland are not only unspeakable, they are unimaginable. Now, the same situation confronts us today when we try to talk about consciousness and how it relates to matter-energy. Go fishing for consciousness using the net of language, and it always, inevitably, slips through the holes in our net. Recognizing the limits of language and of imagination when talking about consciousness opens up a crucially important issue for philosophy of mind and for a science of consciousness. I believe the energy question, that is, the language we use, is central to any significant advance we may make into understanding consciousness and how it relates to the physical world. A major challenge facing philosophers and scientists of consciousness, and in fact anybody else who wishes to talk or think or write about it, is finding the appropriate concepts, words and metaphors. So much of our language is derived from our two most dominant senses of vision and touch. Vision feeds language with spatial metaphors, while touch, or rather kinesthetics, feeds language with muscular push-pull metaphors. These visuo-muscular senses dominate our perception and interaction with the world, and consequently metaphors derived from these senses dominate our ways of conceiving and talking about the world. It is no accident that spatial and mechanical descriptions and explanations predominate in physics, the paradigm science, and our culture's paradigm for all knowledge. Given our evolutionary heritage, with its selective bias toward vision and kinesthetics, we live predominantly in a spatial push-pull world, a world of classical mechanics, a billiard ball universe of moving, colliding, and recoiling massive bodies. Ours is a world of matter in motion, of things in space, acted on by physical forces. It should not be surprising, then, that when we come to talk about consciousness, our grooves of thinking channel us toward physics talk, expressed today as energy talk. But forces are felt, experienced in the body, and we are tempted to think the experience of force is identical to the energy exchanges between bodies described by physics. But this is to confuse the feeler's feeling, the subject, with what is felt, the object. This language problem is at least as old as Descartes' mind-body dualism. When this French philosopher made his famous distinction between mind and matter, he found himself suspended in the language of physics. He could find no better way to define mind than negatively in the terminology of physics. He defined matter as that which occupies space, res extensa, extended things, as we saw in the previous lecture. And he defined the mental world as res cogitans, thinking things. And thinking things differ from physical things in that they do not occupy space. The problem was, how could material physical things interact with non-physical things? As we saw, the problem is, what conceivably could be the nature of their point of contact? Would it be material or mental? Centuries later, Freud too resorted to physics talk when describing the mechanisms and dynamics of the psyche, for example, in his concept of the libido. Today, the same tendency to use energy talk is rife in much New Age dialogue about consciousness, soul, and spirit. Because of our reliance on the senses of vision and kinesthetics, we have an evolutionary predisposition, it seems, to talk in the language of physics or mechanics. Yet all such talk seems to miss something essential when we come to speak of phenomena in the domain of the mind. For example, emotions, desires, beliefs, pains, and other felt qualities of consciousness. The inappropriate clunkiness of mechanistic metaphors borrowed from classical physics seems obvious enough. The mind just isn't at all like matter or machines, as Descartes was keenly aware. But then came Einstein and his relativity, followed by the quantum revolution. First was Einstein's equation E equals MC squared that showed matter was a form of energy. And so, with the advent of quantum theory, the material world began to dissolve into unimaginable paradoxical bundles of energy or action. Matter itself was now understood to be ghostly swirls of energy and began to take on qualities formerly associated with mind. In fact, a great physicist, Sir James Jeans, even declared that the universe begins to look more and more like a great thought than like a great machine. Quantum events were so tiny, so undetermined, so unmechanical in the classical sense, they seemed just the sort of thing that could respond to the influence of mind. The quantum consciousness connection was boosted further by the need, at least in one interpretation of quantum theory, to include the observer and his or her consciousness in any complete description of the collapse of the quantum wave function. The collapse of the quantum wave function describes the event where actual reality emerges from the domain of quantum probabilities, and we will look at that in more detail in a later lecture. According to this view, the quantum system must include the consciousness of the observer for the collapse from possibilities to actuality to take place. Together with ghostly energy fields from relativity and the quantum consciousness connection from quantum physics, This triggered the imaginations of pop science writers and dabblers in New Age pseudoscience. And so now we have shelves of books that invoke the mysteries of the quantum or non-locality as the latest explanations for the age-old questions about consciousness. Quantum theory, many believe, has finally opened the way for science to explore and talk about the mind. But the excitement was and is, I believe, premature. It involves a linguistic and conceptual sleight of hand. Whereas the clunky classical mechanical language of matter was obviously at best metaphorical when applied to consciousness, it now seemed more reasonable to use the language of energy literally, particularly if cloaked in the spooky garb of quantum physics. But this shift from metaphorical matter to literal energy was unwarranted, unfounded, and deceptive. Dissolving matter into energy makes neither of them any less physical. And the mark of the physical, as Descartes had pointed out, is that it is extended in space. Despite the insuperable problems with his dualism, Descartes' key insight remains valid today. What distinguishes mind from matter is precisely that it does not occupy space. And this distinction holds just as fast between mind and energy, even so-called subtle energy. Energy, even in the form of infinitesimal quanta or subtle vibrations, still occupies space. And any theory of energy as a field clearly makes it spatial. Fields are spread out over space. Notions of quantum consciousness, field consciousness, or vibrations, ripples, or waves of consciousness, therefore, are little more than vacuous jargon because they continue to fail to address the very distinction that Descartes formulated nearly 400 years ago. But that's not even the most troublesome deficiency of energy talk. Even supposing physicists were able to show that quanta of energy did not occupy space, suppose the behavior of quanta was so bizarre that they could do all sorts of unphysical things such as transcend space and time, even if it could be shown that quanta were not physical in Descartes' sense, even supposing all of this, any proposed identity between energy and consciousness would still be invalid. Why? Because energy talk fails to account for what is fundamentally most characteristic about consciousness, namely its subjectivity. No matter how fine-grained or subtle energy could become, as an objective phenomenon, it could never account for the fact of subjectivity, that is, the what-it-feels-like-from-within experience. Ontologically, subjectivity just cannot emerge from wholly objective reality. Unless energy, at its ontologically most fundamental level, already came with some form of proto-consciousness, or proto-experience, or proto-subjectivity, then consciousness, experience, or subjectivity would never emerge or evolve in the universe. So although our language is biased toward physics, our energy talk, full of mechanistic metaphors, this is clearly not the whole story. The vernacular of the marketplace, as well as the language of science, is also rich with non-mechanistic metaphors, metaphors that flow directly from experience itself. Ironically, not only do we apply consciousness metaphors to the mind and mental events, but also to the world of matter in our attempts to understand its deeper complexities and dynamics. For example, systems theory and evolutionary biology, even at the reductionist level of molecular genetics, are replete with words such as codes, information, meaning, self-organizing, and function, which is the code for the P word, purpose. So we are not limited to mechanistic metaphors when describing either the world of matter or the world of mind. But, and this is the important point, because of our bias toward visuomuscular images, we tend to forget that metaphors of the mind are sui generis. And because of our scientific and philosophical bias in favor of mechanism, we often attempt to reduce metaphors of the mind to to metaphors of matter. My proposal for consciousness talk is this: to recognize the limitations of mechanistic metaphors and the inappropriateness of literal energy talk when discussing consciousness. Instead, I propose we acknowledge the richness and appropriateness of metaphors of meaning when talking about the mind. Let's drop mechanistic metaphors, our energy talk, and take up meaning metaphors, our consciousness talk, when talking about consciousness. So let's look at this a little bit more closely. Suppose you tune into someone's vibrations. Well, are you picking up some form of energy they are emitting, perhaps something we might call psychic energy? It may be tempting to think so, to think of consciousness as a form of energy, but is it? What might be going on when we say we feel someone's vibrations? Well, one possibility is that their brain or their body could be sending out waves of energy, something perhaps like electricity. If so, it must be far more subtle than any form of energy known to modern science, because no physical instrument has yet devised has been able to detect any such energy. But even if the vibrations were subtle energy waves, they would still be physical, because they pass through space. Anything that moves through space must be located somewhere in space, and anything that is located in space can be measured. That's what physical means. It occupies space, it is objective, it can be measured. But no one has ever measured consciousness. No one has ever been able to pinpoint consciousness in space. If they had, then questions such as, how big is consciousness? Is it an inch, a foot, a mile, a light year? Or, where exactly is consciousness? Such questions would make sense. But they don't. They baffle us. And the same applies to any contents of consciousness, such as a thought, a feeling, or desire. Even though it is absurd to talk about the size of consciousness, some people may not think it so strange to say that consciousness is located somewhere in the brain. But where? No one has ever succeeded in finding any part of the brain, large or small, where consciousness is. Yes, it certainly seems to be associated or correlated with the brain, but it is not in the brain, not in the way your brain is inside your skull. Consciousness has a completely different kind of interiority. So if consciousness has no size and has no location, what does it mean to say it is in space? And if it is not in space, what does it mean to say it is a form of energy? But before we take on this issue, let's pause for a few minutes to clarify what we mean by the key terms, consciousness and energy. The word consciousness was first used in European philosophy by John Locke in the 17th century. And since then, the concept has undergone radical evolution. Today, its meanings are multiple and a great source of confusion in both academic debate and ordinary conversation. Such confusion and misunderstandings hamper clarity and progress in consciousness studies. But the confusion can be avoided, or at least it can be significantly minimized, if we pay attention to how we use the term. As we all know, consciousness is our most intimate reality. Yet paradoxically, once we think about it, it is also our deepest mystery. Like all experience, but even more so, consciousness is ineffable. As soon as we begin to talk about it, it slides from our grasp like a slippery fish. Yet, using the net of language, we can go fishing, and with diligence, we may leave with something to fry or to throw back. And as we move ahead, however, we should always keep in mind that beyond our explorations of language and ideas about consciousness, our venture will produce little but empty abstractions unless we also remember to pay attention to our own lived experience of consciousness, unless we remember that we are also explorers probing our own inner world of direct experience. To give an idea of the journey ahead, I begin with a quote from a previous adventurer in the study of consciousness. "Consciousness is a word worn smooth by a million tongues. Depending upon the figure of speech chosen, it is a state of being, a substance, a process, a place, an epiphenomenon, an emergent aspect of matter, or the only true reality. When we try to define consciousness, we become like one of those figures walking on a paradoxical Escher stairway. While it seems we are getting down to basics, we always end up back where we began." In other words, we need the concept of consciousness to explain consciousness, which, of course, explains nothing very much. Consciousness is, well, it's consciousness. With full frontal tautologies like this, we may well be excused for giving up any attempt at defining consciousness, and then rest content simply with the unspoken experience itself. But then we would be very poor scholars of consciousness, sitting in silence at home or in class, moving deeper into the experiential mystery of consciousness. Enlightening though that project may well be, will not produce sufficient clarity for thinking or talking or for reading or writing about consciousness. So as explorers, we will cover the ground and move on to new vistas. We won't get stuck in definitions. Instead, we will examine different uses and meanings of consciousness and aim for a clearer and more coherent understanding of the kinds of pitfalls and dead ends we are likely to meet along the way. Most of all, we will be on the lookout for distinctions in meanings to help orient the search. Because the word consciousness is notoriously difficult to define and is frequently a source of misunderstanding, it is important to clarify some of its basic meanings. The following will include both a simple outsider's and a more technical insider's clarification. By outsider, I mean someone relatively unfamiliar with the field of consciousness studies, and by insider, I mean someone who has thought about and has read material concerned with this field. So let's begin with the outsider's meaning. The simple meaning is that consciousness knows. Consider this simple equation. The world, or the cosmos, in other words, everything that exists, consists of physical energy and non-physical consciousness. Physical energy plus non-physical consciousness equals everything. That's the equation. Or more simply, the world equals things and experiences of those things. The things are physical objects made of matter and energy, such as stones and trees, thunder and lightning, houses and freeways. And experiences are what know those things. That's what consciousness is. It's what knows or feels or is aware of anything. It's what philosophers mean when they tell us the world consists of objects and subjects. Objects are made of energy or matter. Subjects experience the energy and matter. That's it. That's all there is, in a glorious profusion of forms and manifestations. So the world is made of stuff, matter, energy, and mind or consciousness is what knows or feels or thinks about the stuff. In my book, Radical Nature, I emphasized the distinction between energy and consciousness in the phrase or bumper sticker that I like to use called "Energy flows, consciousness feels." Consciousness is what feels the flow of energy through our bodies. Consciousness is what knows there is any energy at all. In my teaching, I like to help students grasp fundamental points in philosophy by catching the essence of key ideas in what I call bumper stickers. So I tell them that at its deepest level, the world is made up of matter and mind, or energy and consciousness. And the bumper sticker for that is, "Energy flows, consciousness knows." Everything that exists is made of some kind of energy, and energy is always dynamic, always in flux, flowing from one part of the universe to another. But in addition to the objective things that flow, there is the subject that knows or feels the experiences, or feels or experiences those things. And that's what consciousness is. Consciousness is what knows the flow of energy. Consciousness, therefore, is what enables us to feel, think, know, intend, attend, perceive, choose, and create. It is the source of all meaning, value, and purpose in our lives and in the world. Consciousness is interior. It's what enables us to feel and know who we are inside, distinct from our external physical bodies. Now let's go a little deeper and examine two important, though different, meanings from an insider's perspective. So from the insider's perspective, we have the technical meaning. Confusion about consciousness among those already engaged in its study often arises, as far as I can see, because they use the word to mean different things. Let's begin, therefore, with a distinction that will help avoid what is probably the most common confusion whenever two or more people come together to discuss consciousness. It's the distinction between the philosophical, or ontological, and the psychological, or psychoanalytic, meanings of consciousness. For some people, consciousness means more or less being awake, alert, aroused, aware, or simply being conscious, as distinct from being unconscious. And this is the psychological, psychoanalytical meaning. It is the kind of distinction we each encounter every morning. It's the difference between being asleep and waking up. But if we use this meaning, how do we then account for the difference between a sleeping person and, say, a rock or a dead person? It doesn't seem sufficient to say that both the sleeping person and the rock are unconscious in the same way. While it is true that neither the sleeping person nor the rock is awake, it is not true to say that both lack all psychic or sentient capacity. The sleeping person is unconscious, but the rock is non-conscious. The unconscious person's body still responds to stimuli. It still senses and feels. It still has a psychic life. But the rock does not. Now, at the end of this lecture, I've included a short monologue called The Philosopher's Stone on the topic of whether or not rocks have consciousness. I know from past experience that when I use the example of rocks being non-conscious, some people take exception to that, and so I want to address that later on. So again, in short, being unconscious is not the same as being non-conscious. Being unconscious, our lives can still teem with sensations, imagery, and dreams. Unconsciousness, therefore, has a form of consciousness of its own, a form of consciousness never available to a non-conscious entity such as a rock or a beer can or a pack of cigarettes. Psychological consciousness, therefore, is merely one variety, being awake, of a much broader and richer spectrum of consciousness. The philosophical study of consciousness deals with the broader meaning, that is, consciousness as a quality or state of being itself. The ontological meaning of consciousness refers to that ground of being without which there could be no such things as thoughts, emotions, desires, wishes, hopes, fears, or volitions. Consciousness in this sense is an aspect of reality itself. And most of the rest of this course will be concerned with the philosophical meaning of consciousness. So let's recap. The philosophical meaning of consciousness. Here it is used to mean an aspect of reality radically distinct from non-consciousness. And non-consciousness is the total absence of any experience, subjectivity, sentience, feeling, or mentality of any kind whatsoever. The lights are totally out. There's nobody home. And examples often used to illustrate non-consciousness are objects such as rocks, tables, thermostats, computers. In contrast, any entity that is a subject, that feels its own being, possesses consciousness. Consciousness in this sense means the basic raw capacity for sentience, feeling, experience, subjectivity, self-agency, intention, or knowing of any kind whatsoever. It feels like something to be a being with consciousness. The lights are on. There's somebody home. In contrast, the psychological meaning of consciousness is used to mean a state of awareness contrasted with the unconscious. For example, being awake and alert instead of being asleep or dreaming. The light of experience is always on, though the luminosity may vary from dim to glaring brightness, ranging from being psychologically asleep to full spiritual awakening. Even the psychological unconscious has something psychic or mental going on. To be unconscious is still to be a sentient being. Worms, for example, and sleeping people still feel, whereas to be non-conscious is not. Rocks and computers and beer cans just don't feel. So clearly, the philosophical meaning of consciousness is more fundamental because no form of psychological consciousness would be possible, asleep or awake, without at least some trace of philosophical consciousness being present. Examples often used to illustrate being unconscious include sleeping, dreaming, being in a coma, and may include the normal living state of creatures such as worms, starfish, and plants. In contrast, psychological consciousness typically involves phenomena such as cognition, perception, emotion, or volition. And just to confuse things, there is a third meaning of consciousness that's often popular, particularly in spiritual and New Age circles. It's what we might call the spiritual meaning of consciousness. Here, consciousness is used to indicate a higher or more developed or more aware state beyond the ordinary awareness of day-to-day psychological consciousness. Phrases such as, we strive to be conscious beings, or whatever you do, do it with consciousness. These use the term in the spiritual sense. But clearly, from the perspective of the philosophical meaning, we don't have to strive to be conscious beings. We already are beings with consciousness. So this spiritual meaning of consciousness refers to a heightened state of self-awareness that involves increased ethical discernment. Examples often used to illustrate spiritual consciousness include mystical experiences, unconditional love, purity of compassion, and egolessness. Now, since in this case the lights also are always on, spiritual consciousness is really a version of the psychological meaning. And perhaps we might call it psycho-spiritual meaning of consciousness, where the light is approaching optimum brightness. So in another way to think of these different meanings is to picture philosophical consciousness like a light switch. It's digital. It's either on or off. If flipped up, the light is on and consciousness is present. If flipped down, the light is off and there is complete darkness, no consciousness at all. Nobody home. On the other hand, we could picture psychological consciousness more like a dimmer switch. It's analog. It can change gradually. Once the power is on, you can turn up the brightness, that is consciousness, from dim unconscious to sparkling consciousness or enlightenment. The sky's the limit. In this case, the power is always on. It's just a matter of turning up or down the dimmer. So when discussing consciousness, it helps a great deal if we are clear about which version we mean. Do we mean the fact of awareness contrasted with the complete absence of any mental activity whatsoever, which is the philosophical meaning? Or do we mean a state of awareness contrasted with being unconscious, which is the psychological meaning? Or contrasted with low moral or ethical sensitivities, which is the spiritual meaning of consciousness. The difference between the psychological and philosophical meanings is crucially important. If we can keep this distinction in mind whenever a conversation about consciousness comes up, we will be well served in our search for coherence and clarity. Well, so much for consciousness. Let's now shift to the meaning of energy. What is energy? Well, energy also is a slippery creature. Try to pin it down and it disappears like the Cheshire cat. It remains elusive whenever we attempt to define it as a thing or a substance. The best that science can do is offer a functional, operational definition. Energy is the capacity for doing work. Energy, then, is a capacity, a potential for producing activity, for applying a force. But what is it that carries the capacity or the potential? And how can something as abstract as a capacity or potential, something that by definition does not yet fully exist, how can that occupy space? Remember, according to Descartes, anything physical, matter or energy, occupies space. So what is it? Well, Einstein said E equals mc squared, that energy is equal to the mass of an object multiplied by the velocity of light squared. So is energy equal to mass in some way? And since mass is defined by the curvature of space-time, energy may be as nebulous as warps or kinks in the matrix of space-time. Whatever that means. But even so, how does energy get its dynamic character? Forced to give it a definition, we may say that energy is what is exchanged between atoms in their interactions, and the patterns of these exchanges are manifested in the structure of matter. Well, does that help? Perhaps not much. We are left with a vague, intuitive understanding of energy as a kind of homogeneous, primordial flux in which all that has shape in the world is just a series of fleeting vortices. The primordial flux is coextensive with the universe. The physical universe is the total amount of energy. In this view, energy cannot be divided up into neat little pieces with nothing in between. As the flux converges here and there into vortices of concentrated packets of energy quanta, it must diffuse elsewhere. Nothing can happen anywhere in this total energy matrix without it affecting the whole. The universe, it seems, is a kind of cosmic quantum. Within the universe as a whole, energy cannot be created or destroyed. From a thermodynamic systems perspective, energy may be defined as the flow of information or order from regions of high concentration to regions of low concentration. All the bits and pieces of the universe, from galaxies down to elementary particles up to living beings, are all systems of vortices, concentrated packets of energy, all interrelated and interdependent. Every particle in the universe is a thread in the cosmic tapestry, each one woven by all the others. If we attempt to pull out a thread for close examination, we find the rest of the tapestry beginning to fray, and the pattern as a whole becomes incoherent. The universe must be considered as a whole, otherwise it loses meaning. Ultimately, energy is an abstraction. It's a concept we introduce to account for the universe's capacity to do work, to account for the fact that anything at all ever happens. But how can the world of solid material stuff, of tables and chairs, of mountains and cities, be ultimately made up of an abstract concept? It is very difficult, then, to be clear what anybody means by the term energy. It is similar to the word force in that it seems to explain something, but actually only disguises a deeper mystery. For the purposes of this course, we will use the physicist's definition, vague though it is, where energy refers to some physical quantity. It is something that can be measured, even though neither we nor the scientists really know what it is that's been measured. And since energy is a physical quantity, we should not assume that it is appropriate to use the term when talking about the nature or dynamics of consciousness. So, back to our earlier question. If energy, or matter, is defined as stuff that occupies space and moves through space, and remember that's what physical means, then how could consciousness be a form of energy? After all, we know that consciousness has no size and has no location. So what could it mean to say it is in space? And if consciousness is not in space, what does it mean to say it is a form of energy? Perhaps then, consciousness is a form of non-physical energy. Well, let's look at this more closely. How are consciousness and energy related? Well, we have three options. One, we could say that consciousness is a physical form of energy, even if it is very, very, very subtle energy. Or two, consciousness is a non-physical form of energy. And our third option is that consciousness is not any form of energy at all. So, if we say that consciousness is a physical form of energy, then we are reducing consciousness and spirit ultimately to physics. And few of us, unless we're materialists, really feel all that comfortable reducing spirit to physics. So, we are unlikely to say that consciousness is a form of physical energy. So that leaves us the second option, that consciousness is a non-physical form of energy. In which case, then we need to say in what way non-physical or psychic energy differs from physical energy. And if we cannot explain what we mean by psychic energy and how it differs from physical energy, then we should ask ourselves, why use the term energy at all? Which brings us to our third option. Our third alternative is to say that consciousness is not a form of energy in any way, either physical or non-physical. Unlike energy, which is some kind of stuff spread out in space, consciousness isn't made of stuff and is not located in space. If this is true, then consciousness would not only be different from energy, it would be non-located. Now, this is not to imply that consciousness has nothing to do with energy. In fact, the position I emphasize, which is panpsychism or radical naturalism, is that consciousness and energy always go together. They cannot ever be separated. But this is not to say they are not distinct. Yes, they are distinct. Energy is energy, and consciousness is consciousness. But they are inseparable, like two sides of a coin. Or better still, like the shape and substance of a tennis ball. You can't separate the shape from the substance of the ball, but shape and substance are definitely distinct. So, for example, some spiritual traditions talk of kundalini experiences, where a meditator may feel a rush of energy up the chakra system. But to say that such energy flow is consciousness is to mistake the object, the energy flow, for the subject, for what perceives or feels or knows the object, in other words, consciousness. Now note there are two importantly distinct words in the phrase, feel the rush of energy. On the one hand, there is the feeling. On the other, there is what is being felt or experienced, the energy. So even our way of talking about it reveals that we detect a distinction between feeling, consciousness, and what we feel, energy. Yes, the two go together, but they are not the same. Unity, or unification, or holism, does not equal identity. To say that one aspect of reality, consciousness, cannot be separated from another aspect of reality, matter-energy, is not to say both aspects of reality, consciousness and matter-energy, are identical. Consciousness, I am suggesting, is neither identical to energy, which is the worldview of monism, held by both materialism and idealism, nor is it a separate substance or energy in addition to physical matter or energy, which is the worldview of dualism. Instead, consciousness, I'm saying, is the interiority, the what it feels like from within, the subjectivity intrinsic to the reality of all matter and energy, and this is the worldview of panpsychism or radical naturalism. I am proposing that it is a mistake, it is an error to speak of consciousness as though it were a form of energy. Yet they cannot be separated. Wherever there is consciousness, there is energy, and vice versa. As we said earlier, energy flows, consciousness knows. Consciousness is the witness that experiences the flow of energy, but it is not the flow of energy. We could say consciousness is the felt interiority of energy matter. Now, to grasp this experientially, you just might take a moment to pay attention to what's going on right now in your own body. The physical matter of your body, including the flow of whatever energies are pulsing through you, are the stuff of your organism. But there is also a part of you that is aware of or feels the pumping of your blood and other energy streams. The aspect of you that feels the matter energy in your body is your consciousness. We could express it this way. Consciousness is the process of matter energy informing itself. Consciousness is the ability that matter energy has to feel, to know, and to direct itself. The universe is full of energy flows, vortices, and vibrations, but without consciousness, all this activity would be completely unfelt and unknown. Only because there is consciousness can the flow of energy be felt, known, and purposefully detected and directed. So, to conclude, I'm suggesting that when discussing consciousness, we avoid using energy talk, and instead get into the habit of using consciousness talk. Now, this may be difficult at first because our language, as we saw, is riddled with metaphors derived from our two dominant senses of vision and touch. Our language drips with mechanistic metaphors related to colors, shapes, sizes, and to push-pull metaphors derived from our body's kinesthetics. Energy and mechanism do dominate our language. But we don't need to stay stuck in energy talk. Our language also has many very useful words specific to consciousness itself, words such as purpose, choice, intention, attention, desire, volition, sentience, value, and of course, meaning. And none of these words are reducible to mechanics or to physics. Instead of mechanism and energy talk, I'm proposing we get used to exploring consciousness with appropriate consciousness talk, looking for explanations in terms of meaning rather than mechanism. Earlier on, I mentioned that I would talk a little bit about the idea that rocks don't have consciousness, or whether rocks do have consciousness. And I have a little story that illustrates the issue that I've called the Philosopher's Stone, and I'd like to end this lecture with that story. "It just doesn't feel right," she protested, unhappy at the suggestion that perhaps rocks don't have consciousness. She looked genuinely troubled as I held up the stone. "My job as a philosophy teacher," I said, "is to get students to think outside the box, to become more conscious of how they think. This is not supposed to be an exercise in what to think. It is not about finding right ideas." I rubbed the stone, the rounded stone, between my fingers, feeling the paradox of its cool warmth. "Donna," I said, "I'm not asking you to change any particular belief about rocks. If you think rocks or stones are conscious, that's fine." Though silently, I wondered why it seemed to matter so much to her that lumps of granite pulsed with what she called vibrations. In my experience, rocks, immobile, inert, unresponsive, hard and cold, are the very epitome of something that's thoroughly non-conscious. Of course I could be wrong, but how could we ever tell for sure? The issue isn't whether rocks really do or do not have consciousness, I went on, unconsciously stroking the stone against my chin, searching for the best words. There really isn't any decisive way to know. There's no conclusive test for consciousness. I hesitated, knowing that actually there's no kind of test at all. Whether or not rocks or anything else have consciousness is a scientific question, and as things stand, science cannot even begin to answer the question. But scientists would laugh at the idea of rock consciousness, another student blurted out as a question, wouldn't they? Yes, I do believe most of them would, I agreed, and went on to explain how that's a good example of a metaphysical prejudice masquerading as scientific knowledge. Without having the faintest idea how to test such a belief, most scientists I know would insist that the idea of rock consciousness is absurd. It's like, believe first, ask questions later, the student mumbled to her neighbor. That's not science, I said. It's scientism. Still agreeing. It's bad science. It's confusing the how with the what, the process of thinking with the contents of thinking. Well, I could see that this last statement drew blank looks, so I tried to explain. What you've just identified about so-called scientific thinking about rocks serves as a good example of where I'd like you to focus your awareness. A rustle echoed around the room as students shifted in their seats. Notice how these scientists, whoever they are, engage in a form of thinking we might call jumping to conclusions. They believe that only creatures with brains could have consciousness. And since rocks don't have brains, therefore rocks couldn't have consciousness. That kind of thinking is called a syllogism. And it's quite valid as stated. Yes, if it's true that only brains have consciousness, then the conclusion logically follows rocks don't have consciousness. But that's a philosophical conclusion, not a scientific one. Science works by testing the ifs, using experiments that yield tangible evidence. And there's no tangible evidence for consciousness, not only in rocks, but in human beings too. Even philosophically, the conclusion hinges on the truth or accuracy of the initial premise, which is only creatures with brains have consciousness. Well, is that really true? The second premise, rocks don't have brains, is not a problem. Plenty of people, including scientists, have split open rocks and nobody has ever seen a brain inside. But for the conclusion, rocks can't be conscious to be true, both premises would have to be true. And we simply do not know whether the first premise, only brains have consciousness, is true. To believe so in advance of testing the hypothesis is scientism, not science. Looking at the sea of faces, I could see I'd completely lost them by now. So how could I make the point more clearly? What I'm trying to get at here is that science is about discovering what the actual world is really like, whereas philosophy is about exploring possible worlds. Science is interested in whether brains actually produce consciousness and whether rocks actually really do have consciousness or not. Philosophy, on the other hand, is interested in, for example, whether it's possible that consciousness could exist without brains, or if it's possible that rocks could exist with or without consciousness. I was still struggling, so I turned to Donna again. When I asked you to think of something that didn't have consciousness, I suggested a rock might be a good example of such a thing. But you didn't agree, because you felt uncomfortable. It didn't feel quite right, you said. And you may indeed be correct. Perhaps rocks do have consciousness. But I'd like you now to be open to the possibility that either you may be mistaken, or that in some other world it's possible that rocks don't have consciousness. You don't even have to give up your belief. I'd just like you to entertain the possibility. Can you do that? She squirmed a little in her chair, and after a long silence, her face strained from some internal struggle, said, "No, I just don't believe it's possible." "Why wouldn't it be possible?" I asked, trying to hide a growing impatience. "Because it just doesn't feel right," she said. Well, we'd come full circle. I searched frantically for a new tack. The clock was hungrily devouring the minutes as the hands inched their way toward 9:45. "Maybe it doesn't feel right to the scientists to consider the possibility of rocks having consciousness," I said. "You would feel one thing, they'd feel the exact opposite. Who'd be right? How would we decide?" Donna thought for a moment. "Well, maybe there's no right," she came back. "Maybe we'd both be right in our own way." I'd lost. But I couldn't leave it alone. I said, "How could the same thing, our rock, both have consciousness and not have consciousness at the same time? That's a contradiction. It doesn't make sense. It's incoherent." My frustration was beginning to show by now as the pitch of my voice climbed an octave. But her coup de grace was about to come. "According to your logic, maybe, that's either or thinking. In my way of thinking, it's both and." At that point, I finally gave up. I realized the truth staring me in the face. I said to her, "Then we can't communicate. We can't understand each other. If you are talking from a world where you believe both and logic applies to contradictory statements, then I have no way of making rational sense of what you say. In my world, some statements do require understanding in either or terms. The same thing, a rock, cannot be both in one state, conscious, and its exact opposite, non-conscious, at the same time. All meaning breaks down for me at that point." Well, capitalizing on her winning hand, she threw out, "Only if you are looking for meaning through reason and logic." Bingo. That's it. Maybe I had an opening after all. "That's precisely what I'm looking for," I said, now with a sense of desperation, tinged with a flicker of hope. "We are now communicating through language, which is the expression of concepts. And for concepts to hang together coherently, to make sense, we have to honor the rules of rationality and logic. I'm looking for conceptual coherence. I'm not saying that whatever fits together rationally is necessarily true in the actual world. After all, there's no reason whatsoever that reality should fit our concepts. I'm saying that for me to understand what you say about the world, I need to hear ideas that fit together coherently. And contradictory statements cancel each other out. They do not fit." Was I finally getting a foothold? I wondered. The ticking of the clock picked its way through the silence as I waited for her response. "Well, if you want me to just think that it's possible for a rock to be non-conscious, okay, I can do that. But it still doesn't feel right. And I don't believe it's true." I was back in the driving seat. That's all I wanted you to do all along. Engage in a thought experiment. That's all philosophy is. Now you're beginning to think like a philosopher. After class, when the last student had left, I sat there with the stone between my hands resting on my lap. I fingered its smooth curves, emptying my mind of all the day's thoughts, absent-mindedly concentrating on the heft and solidity of the rock. 3 or 4 billion years ago, this fragment of planet had been spewed out by some fire-breathing volcano. It cooled and found its place among the Earth's earliest ancestors. Some rocks got digested and transformed by primitive bacteria and entered the stream of living systems. Others, like this one, remained as they had been for millions, for billions of years. There was something very special about such an ancient, almost eternal object. If only I could see the eons of changes it weathered, recorded somehow in its elements. I closed my eyes, and I held the stone lightly, feeling for its almost imperceptible grooves. For a moment, fleetingly, I could have sworn it carried a silent message. Well, that brings us to the end of session 4. Our next session, Quantum Consciousness, we will look further into the uses of metaphors borrowed from physics. Specifically, we will explore the bizarre world of the quantum, and we will ask, can quantum physics enlighten us about consciousness? In looking for an answer, we will find out what's so special about the quantum. See you next session.